Once again, we will be continuing the analysis of the events that we're looking at and the forces that we're looking at over the next several weeks, and that will add historical depth to the development of these forces. We're going to take a look at how the forces that we've just looked at engaged in literally a coup, a fascist coup in the United States, namely the assassination of President Kennedy. We're going to take a look at how these forces developed, and we will take a look at the implications for the United States in weeks to come. The last section of the broadcast this evening, what we're going to be looking at, concerns the way in which this Galen-ABN milieu, which, as we've seen, intersects directly with the intelligence community, with the national security establishment of the United States, with the American far right, John Birch Society, Hunt Walker elements. We're going to take a look at how this particular axis, and I use the term advisedly, developed. This axis developed as a result of not only the incorporation of these Galen-ABN-related elements into the U.S. intelligence system, but specifically as a result of the introduction of these same elements into the political life of the United States, and this under the auspices of American intelligence fronts, CIA fronts, in the United States. That's one of the things we're going to be looking at right now. One of the major points that I want to underscore here is how these forces represent a culmination of the covert action and psychological warfare techniques and political warfare that were developed by the Third Reich during the Second World War and which were then carried to the United States under the auspices of the Galen Organization and organizations like the NTS and the ABN, and how ultimately they have reached their fulfillment vis-a-vis policy towards the former Soviet Union. And in weeks to come, we're going to see how they are in the process of fulfilling their policy towards the United States. The last section of tonight's program is going to deal with the genesis of rollback or liberation theory. This obviously is represented or incarnated in the persona of the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. As we've seen, the Kennedy administration's State Department under Dean Rusk was opposed to this, and as we've also seen, not only in tonight's program, but in particular in Radio Free America 36 and its various addenda, the agenda of the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations and the Galen Organization has been realized in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. We're now going to read from a book called Blowback, subtitled The First Full Account of America's Recruitment of Nazis and Its Disastrous Effect on Our Domestic and Foreign Policy. This book was authored by Christopher Simpson. It was published in hardcover by Weidenfeld and Nicholson, and it was copyrighted 1988. And of the genesis of rollback or liberation theory, and that particular theory, as opposed to the containment theory of fighting the Cold War, had its genesis not only with some of these Galen-ABN-related elements, but specifically they were introduced into American political life through CIA domestic intelligence fronts, and as we shall see, the methodology and the goals of this Galen organization and related elements operating in and through the American national security establishment represents a direct continuity of methodology and goals from the Third Reich's covert action, political and psychological warfare programs. Simpson writes, at the conclusion of Chapter 14, one of the most important characteristics of the war criminals who did come to the United States is that they did not arrive here as isolated individuals. As has been seen in the cases of the Croatian Ustashi, the Ukrainian OUN, and the Latvian Vanagis, V-A-N-A-G-I-S, to name only three, many of these immigrants were in fact part of experienced, highly organized groups with distinct political agendas that differed little from the fascist programs they had promoted in their homelands. The anti-communist paranoia of the McCarthy period gave these groups fertile soil in which to put down roots and to grow. And then in Chapter 15, entitled The Politics of Liberation, Simpson goes on, The Central Intelligence Agency did not sever its ties with the extremist exile organizations once they had arrived in this country. Instead, it continued to use them in clandestine operations both abroad and in the United States itself. Before the middle of the 1950s, the agency found itself entangled with dozens and probably hundreds of former Nazis and SS men who had fought their way into the leadership of a variety of Eastern European emigre political associations inside this country. Instead of withdrawing its support for the extremist groups and for the men and women who led them, the CIA went to considerable lengths to portray these leaders as legitimate representatives of the countries they had fled. At about the same time that the agency initiated the immigration programs discussed in the last chapter, it dramatically expanded its publicity and propaganda efforts inside the United States itself. A major theme of this effort was to establish the credibility and legitimacy of exiled Eastern European politicians, former Nazi collaborators and non-collaborators alike, in the eyes of the American public. Through the National Committee for a Free Europe, or NCFE, and a new CIA finance group, the Crusade for Freedom, or CFF, the Covert Operations Division of the agency became instrumental in introducing into the American political mainstream many of the right-wing extremist emigre politicians' plans to, quote, liberate, unquote, Eastern Europe and to, quote, roll back communism, unquote. Skipping ahead in Chapter 15, Simpson writes, although it was little known in the United States at the time, the genesis of the liberation philosophy can be clearly traced to emigre propagandists who had worked for the Nazis on the Eastern Front during World War II. After the war, the various conservative and liberal anti-communist organizations in the United States that adopted liberation as a rallying cry added new and specifically American elements to the program that altered the earlier German strategy in basic ways. Liberation, in its American version, included an insistence that the anti-communist revolutions be democratic rather than fascist in character, and it abandoned the racial theories and anti-Semitism of the earlier Nazi propaganda. Liberation, in the United States' hands, was billed as the fulfillment of America's own revolutionary heritage of resistance to tyranny. By the way, I would interject that I would take that with a grain of salt. Unfortunately, although the rhetoric may have remained, quote, democratic, unquote, the realities did not. Continuing, it is useful to look at the gradual evolution of how these changes took place. The political rhetoric of the extremist exile groups that had once worked for the Nazis also evolved in a complex interaction with the gradual introduction of liberationist thinking into America. By the late 1940s, exiled extremist leaders had learned the rhetoric of this new, more, quote, American, unquote, form of liberation. Their adoption of lip service to democracy began to provide former fascists with a platform to promote their agenda to millions of Americans, and it created a shelter, in effect, that protected them from the exposure of their Nazi past. They were no longer seen as the trigger men of Nazi genocide in the public mind, but rather as fervent anti-communist patriots. The government's intelligence agencies played a substantial role in this shift. And I would add, it is under the auspices of those agencies that the petroleum industry, intelligence community, American far right, and Galen Link that we have been looking at this evening was formed. The changes in the rhetoric of the extreme Russian nationalist organization Национальная Трудовая Союз, or NTS, which is still active in today's Russian emigration, are a case in point. Recall, we've taken a look at the NTS at great length this evening. Continuing with Simpson's text, this once openly fascist group was founded in the early 1930s by a congress of younger Russian exiles who had fled their homeland in the wake of the 1917 revolution. During the first decade of its existence, the NTS proclaimed the Nazis as models. NTS members were contemptuous of any sort of democratic norms and of the United States, which they viewed as degenerate. Their party program called for an anti-communist revolution in the USSR, assassination of Soviet leaders, disenfranchisement of Jews, and confiscation of Jewish property. When the war broke out, the NTS unhesitatingly rallied to the cause of Nazi Germany. NTS strategy during the conflict, now this is during World War II, beginning again, NTS strategy during the conflict centered on an attempt to convince the Germans to sponsor its members as the new rulers of a puppet state inside the Nazi-occupied zone of the USSR. They gradually became a central part of the Germans' Vlasov Army political warfare project, serving as political officers and informers among the Eastern European troops who had defected to the Nazis. By the way, Vlasov only has one S. There's a misprint in the Scott text. Continuing. As a declassified U.S. State Department study on the group puts it, the NTS, quote, served in the good graces of the Germans, and it placed its men into the Kriegsgefangenenkommissionen, that's spelled K-R-I-E-G-S-G-E-F-A-N-G-E-N-K-O-M-M-I-S-S-I-O-N-E-N, beginning again, as a declassified U.S. State Department study on the group puts it, the NTS, quote, served in the good graces of the German, and it placed its men into the Kriegsgefangenenkommissionen, part of the Nazi prisoner of war camp administration frequently used for interrogation and recruitment of defectors, into the special camps for politically reliable prisoners, and above all, into the propagandist schools at Wüstgrau and Dabendorf, D-A-B-E-N-D-O-R-F, as well as into the Goebbels anti-Comintern, unquote, a Nazi-sponsored alliance of fascist parties from around the world. Again quoting, graduates of the NTS training program, the study continues, were assigned to positions in German-occupied Russia, such as chiefs of police, deputy mayors, and propagandists with army units. Interrupting, of course, we've taken a look at not only the anti-Comintern, but its reconstituted elements inside of, in the WACCFL. What we're going to look at next is how the NTS program developed under the auspices of Third Reich, in particular, its methodology developed as part of the Third Reich's covert operation and psychological and political warfare policy reached its fruition as a result of the incorporation of NTS and other elements of the Galen-ABN axis into the U.S. intelligence system, and as we've seen, it was the introduction of these elements into mainstream American political life which permitted the formation of the axis that we've been looking at tonight. Continuing. Many of the NTS leaders of the 1950s, particularly those who served as police and city administrators in the Nazi occupation zone, are major war criminals who personally helped organize the identification, roundup, and execution of millions of Jewish and Slavic citizens. Insofar as NTS men won control of local administrations in the Nazi-occupied regions of the USSR, the organization became an integral part of the Nazis' propaganda, espionage, and extermination apparatus in the East. The main theme of NTS propaganda throughout the Second World War was a campaign to, quote, liberate, unquote, the USSR from Stalin, communism, and the Jews through a mutiny by the Red Army. The last sentence again, because we can see in the abortive 1991 coup a realization of these goals developed by NTS under Third Reich auspices and then carried forth into the Cold War period as a result of the injection of these elements into the U.S. national security establishment and through their injection into the national security establishment, their projection into mainstream American political life. That sentence again. The main theme of NTS propaganda throughout the Second World War was a campaign to, quote, liberate, unquote, the USSR from Stalin, communism, and the Jews through a mutiny by the Red Army. This became the centerpiece of Vlasov Army recruiting efforts at least as early as 1942 and was elaborated in considerable detail with tactics for counterinsurgency operations in the Nazi occupation zone, behind the lines infiltration of NTS agents on espionage and sabotage missions, propaganda themes tailored to appeal to Russian sensibilities, and similar specifics. When the Germans were finally driven out of Russia, selected NTS agents were left on, quote, stay-behind, unquote, missions in an attempt to organize subversion in Soviet rear areas once the Red Army front had passed. The NTS also served as the dominant force after the Nazis themselves and the Ruskaya Osvoboditel, that's O-S-V-O, it's R-U-S-S-K-A-J-A, O-S-V-O-B-O-D-I-T-E-L, Naya Armaya, the Russian Army of Liberation, or Vlasov Army, And the comment at Ozvobizhodnaya Narodov Rossai, German-sponsored Committee for the Liberation of the Peoples of Russia, the Nazis' primary front group for Eastern Front political warfare operations in the desperate closing months of the war. That last, by the way, that those are spelled RussKagaOsvobodilNaiaArmiia and KOMITETOZVOBOZHDENIANARODOVROSSI. It was through the NTS and through the rival National Liberation Program sponsored among Soviet minority groups by the Nazis' Rosenberg Ministry that the strategy and tactics of the liberation of the USSR were first hammered out. These were the laboratories, so to speak, used by Hans Heinrich Herwarth, H-E-R-W-A-R-T-H, Gustav Hilger, H-I-L-G-E-R, and the other German political warfare officers discussed earlier to develop the propaganda themes and behind-the-lines subversion tactics believed most suitable for reaching people inside the USSR. Well, again, we looked at, during the course of the broadcast this evening, the tactical and methodological operational principles of the NTS, which, as we've seen here, were developed as a major component of the Third Reich's covert action and psychological and political warfare operations. And specifically, the centerpiece of NTS tactical methodology was to overthrow communism inside the USSR by promoting a mutiny in the Red Army. Now, it is, I think, relatively easy to see the fulfillment of this tactical and operational approach with the mutiny of the Soviet Army in the August 1991 coup, in which they literally mutinied against the hardline communist leaders who were attempting to overthrow Gorbachev. After the coup, I observed that in all probability the reason for the failed coup was that the Soviets were deeply infiltrated, that if I could sit and predict that such a coup would happen as a result of U.S. covert operations inside of the Soviet Union, which I went into in Radio Free America 36, the U.S. intelligence apparat and those of other countries with their infinitely greater capabilities would have been able to anticipate and infiltrate that coup, and indeed some of the addenda to Radio Free America 36 have made it fairly clear that in fact that is what happened. Now I would note that just as the final overthrow of the Communist Party in the Soviet Union was effected through a realization of the methodology of the NTS, one of the Russian emigre groups that, again, was cultivated under the auspices of the Third Reich, and whose tactics were cultivated under the auspices of the Third Reich, it then jumped to the U.S. intelligence system, and these emigre groups were projected into American political life, and that as a result of the operations of CIA domestic organizations, and it was their projection into American political life which permitted the formation of the Petroleum Intelligence American right-wing Galen Axis, which we've been focusing on this evening. Bear in mind that the coup happened while George Bush, former director of the CIA, was president of the United States, and in a miscellaneous archive show done in September of 1988 entitled Nazis and Anti-Semites on the Bush Campaign, we took a look at many of these same Galen ABN-related elements on the presence of them on the Republican Ethnic Heritage Council, including, among others, Laszlo Pastor, the veteran of the Hungarian Arrow Cross organization who became the director of Eastern European activities for the Free Congress Foundation, deeply linked not only to the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, but also to Boris Yeltsin. Now, the NTS methodology of promoting a mutiny by the Red Army was realized under George Bush in 1991, but the goals that were achieved as a result of the successful use of this methodology were those of the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, a rival Soviet emigre group, which also worked for Galen and for U.S. intelligence and was involved with the axis that we've been looking at this evening, involved in the assassination of President Kennedy. Again, in the newly independent Ukraine, we have the Ruch organization, which evolved directly from Stefan Bandera of the OUN-UPA, whom we've looked at this evening. And in the Russian Republic, again, we have Boris Yeltsin, very close to the Free Congress Foundation, in turn deeply linked with the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations. Related elements are also ascendant in the Baltic states. So what we have seen in 1991 is, again, the use of the NTS methodology of infiltrating and turning the Soviet army, and the realization of the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations goals of fragmenting the former Soviet Union into its constituent ethnic republics. And in opposition to that, I will begin winding the broadcast up this evening by reading an article from the Los Angeles Times of Saturday, August 1st of 1992. This is a Reuters story, headline, "Soviets Lost Secret War," in quotes, ex-spy says, subheaded Russia. The former head of intelligence compliments German, French, and U.S. opponents. It's datelined Moscow, and it reads in part, "The Soviet Union's last KGB spymaster acknowledged Friday that Moscow had lost the, quote, secret war, unquote, of espionage, and paid tribute to German, French, and U.S. opponents. Leonid Shebarshin, S-H-E-B-A-R-S-H-I-N, dismissed as head of the KGB's intelligence section after last August's failed coup, said Russians who had spied for Washington were driven by, quote, boundless selfishness and egoism compounded by absence of any strength of will," unquote. Again, quoting, "These people betrayed us. They will betray America," unquote. He told Komsomolskaya Pravda newspaper. That's K-O-M-S-O-M-O-L-S-K-A-Y-A, Pravda newspaper. Continuing, Shebarshin, head of overseas intelligence for more than 2 years until sacked by former President Mikhail S. Gorbachev, said he regretted the huge cost of the East-West Cold War. Quote, "The secret war was a component of the Cold War. Our side lost that war," unquote, he said. Quote, "I hope we draw lessons from that," unquote. And skipping down and again quoting, "I would rank both German services among those deserving a special respect, Section 1 of the East German Secret Service, which no longer exists, and West Germany's BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, as well as the French," unquote, he said. He said that from a professional point of view, the Iraqis and Israelis had also performed well. Again quoting, "The United States CIA deserves special mention, enormous money, enormous scope, enormous drive. That brings results," unquote, he said. Well, of course, the BND, as we know, was the final incarnation of the Galen Organization, and the CIA, obviously, is inextricably linked with the Galen Organization, as we have seen in so many different broadcasts. And as the former head of the KGB has noted, the Soviet Union lost that secret war. We've been looking at that secret war, and the decisive element in that secret war was when the United States also lost its own secret war, that when the elements that we've been looking at this evening successfully overthrew the legitimate constitutional representative, namely President Kennedy. The assassination of John Kennedy was not only a military coup, but a fascist coup. It represented, as I've said, the resolution of a decades-old conflict between the military and the executive branch. The military has long chafed at the idea of having a civilian commander-in-chief. It represented the triumph of rollback or liberation theory of fighting the Cold War, with its genesis in the Galen Group that we've seen, over containment theory, and it also represented the coming of fascism to America. We will be looking at that in weeks to come. The last item in tonight's broadcast will be a very short section from another article in Covert Action Information Bulletin number 41 from the summer of 1992. This particular article is called "The U.S. Economy, the Enemy Within." It's authored by Doug Henwood, H-E-N-W-O-O-D. And skipping well down into this particular article, we're going to read a short section which illustrates how the prosecution of the Cold War and the triumph of the elements that we have been examining this evening, and we will continue to examine in the rest of Radio Free America 37, how they represent the culmination of the Third Reich's geopolitical goals, and these goals having been realized through the United States. Henwood writes, "Militarily, the U.S. is coasting on its superpower reputation, but when it comes to cash, the U.S. repeatedly comes up short. Larger military adventures now require foreign approval and foreign cash. Financial limitations have also forced Washington into a secondary role into the restructuring of the former socialist world. Although U.S. policy in large measure did in the reds, German firms will probably make most of the profits picking over the remains. And as we've seen, U.S. policy stemmed directly from Third Reich policy. That is the full court press strategy described by Sean Gervaisi in Radio Free America programs 35 and 39. It bankrupted the Soviet Union, all right, but it also bankrupted us. And some of the implications of that we will be looking at in weeks to come as we develop Radio Free America program number 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War.